Welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
To me, being perfect is not about that scoreboard out there.
This is a chance of a lifetime.
When you can understand the person, you can then work towards a common goal.
We are all on the same team.
Know your role and do it to the best of your ability.
Focus on the fundamentals. We've gone over time and time again.
Your defense has got to be better.
Leave no doubt tonight.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
Hello and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast, where we believe that there is no algorithm for leadership, and so we interview great sports coaches from around the world to try and find ideas to help all of us be better leaders. Our great coach on this episode is Glenn Pocknell. Glenn is a New Zealand cricket coach with over 20 years' experience at the elite level. He started coaching youth representative teams in 2002. He eventually joined the Wellington Firebirds in the New Zealand National League as an assistant coach. He then went to England, Ireland, and the Netherlands to gather international experience and eventually returned to New Zealand and became the Wellington head coach. In that role, he led the team to win all three domestic titles: the Ford Trophy for 50-over one-day cricket in 2019, the Plunkett Shield for four-day cricket in 2020, and back-to-back Super Smash T20 titles in 2020 and 2021. In 2021, he was also given his first chance to lead the New Zealand national team in a T20 series. Glenn has a deep commitment to self-development and the craft of coaching. And in this gem of an interview, some of the highlights are the story of how he wrote a 10-year vision for himself that led from him being a factory worker to eventually coaching the New Zealand national cricket team. The way he uses routines and imagery to help combat negative self-talk with athletes, and the answer he gives around trying not to give feedback, but instead just to listen, and why this is difficult as the leader, but can also be very powerful. I hope you enjoyed as much as we did. And just before we go to the interview, if you like what we do here at The Great Coaches, then head over to our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com, where you will find loads of exclusive audio and video content. It's designed to download and share and bring a different perspective to the challenges that your team might be facing. And now, please enjoy our interview with Glenn Pocknell.
You're listening to The Great Coaches Podcast.
So good morning, Glenn Pocknell, and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Good morning, Paul. How are you?
I'm going okay. A bit early in the morning here, getting ready. Kids are upstairs getting ready for school, and I'm very excited to be talking a little bit of cricket with you. Glenn, something really simple to kick us off today. Where are you in the world, and what have you been up to so far?
I'm in Wellington, New Zealand, and probably similar to you, I started my day off with a couple of crazy kids waking up the household. Mine are young, 6 and 2, so they're very dependent on mum and dad. So it was a chaotic start to the day, which was great. And then I headed off to the Westpac Stadium, or the Sky Stadium, which is now called in Wellington, which is the home of the mighty Wellington Hurricanes. We have an indoor facility down there where Cricket Wellington are based, along with the base reserve, and spend a couple of hours down there doing a bit of admin. I'm in the last week of my role with Cricket Wellington before I shift to CD Cricket up the road. And then had to go and pick my son up early from daycare to take him to the doctor. So it's been an eventful day filled with a bit of work, a bit of play, and a lot revolved around the kids.
Well, we're going to talk about Wellington, we're going to talk about CD, and we might even talk about the Black Caps as well in there. So very much looking forward to this discussion. But Glenn, could I start by just name-checking a couple of the really good coaches you've had experience with? Jamie Siddons, there's Mark Bothwick, and of course there's Mike Hessen. And I'm sure you've seen many others along your journey as you've travelled around the world with cricket. But I'm wondering, from your perspective, what is it you think the great coaches do differently that sets them apart?
Yeah, it's a great question. And for me, it's the ones that can really sum up an environment quickly. And from there, understand what the environment needs, so some adaptability, some flexibility in terms of the way they coach. not always the same style, but summing up all those factors and then determining what style is best for the group. That's definitely the thing that I believe separates the best coaches in the world, and some of those guys you mentioned are outstanding at that. And it certainly comes with experience.
Glenn, when you were 18, you were working as a guillotine operator in a factory. I guess, firstly, I should describe what a guillotine is. It's a blade that chops objects like wood. And this was 2002. Then in 2005, you write yourself a 10-year plan to get to a coaching position at Wellington, which, of course, eventuated. So I want to start by asking, what advice do you have for others now when it comes to long-term planning?
Yeah, it's another really interesting question, because I never would have envisioned myself writing a 10-year plan. I've never really been able to look too much further than a day ahead. But I guess to start it off was, you know, I was having a discussion with my dad about my vision and my goals and where I felt I would like to go, and he suggested, you know, a 10-year plan. And at the time, you kind of laugh about it and have a bit of a joke about it, but I did it. You know, thankfully, a lot of it actually came to fruition. And I don't know why. I don't know if it was just pure luck. But I guess to answer your question, the advice I would give people is try and be really visionary. And what I mean by that is make it the biggest dream possible, the thing that you think you're never going to achieve, but you really want to achieve. And then make it visible for you, and that's what I did. I made it visible. I always had a little pocket in my wallet where every time I opened it, it had there what my vision was and what goal was. And I made some pictures of some, at the time, some Wellington Firebirds players. So every time I saw it, it really created some really positive endorphins and adrenaline, and it just made me a really happy, motivated, positive person. And with that, it gave me that sense of every single day I was contributing to eventually, hopefully, fulfilling that vision, that dream of 10 years down the track. So I think that would be the one piece of advice is, you know, dream big, you know, make it visible. For me, I shared it with a lot of people as well. Some people say don't share it, keep it to yourself. But I shared it with a lot of people because that in some ways made me accountable to it. What it also did is it brought along a lot of other people along for the ride with me who helped me and supported me, which at the end of the day is you're going to need that in whatever facet or career you turn to in life. So, as I said at the start, I never would have envisaged kind of writing that. And I'm probably in the process now of looking 10 years ahead and seeing what that looks like. And the first question is always the hardest. Where do I want to be in 10 years? So that's the next challenge for me.
Well, you just said in there in your answer that you shared it with people. And I understand you did share it with one person in particular, and the advice you got was to get out of your comfort zone. How did that experience of getting out of your comfort zone shape you as a leader?
Yeah, it did. Like it was probably a couple of years after that, but, you know, it was a CEO at the time, Gavin Larson, who is now the chairman of selectors for the Black Caps. You know, I shared this with him and he basically said, well, you've got to leave Wellington, you've got to go overseas. And I was a little bit shocked to kind of hear that. Great advice, great honesty. And he said the reasonings are because you need to get out of your comfort zone. Just as you've said, you need to explore the world. You need to be in different environments because it's going to grow you as a person. And that's ultimately what it did, being in environments where I was uncomfortable, where I didn't know the people, I couldn't speak their language. Culturally, we're on completely different wavelengths. I found that my natural persona and my natural character of being calm and considered really had to be at the forefront of everything I did, whether that be coaching or whether that be going to the supermarket. So it tested that. It tested that that character trait or that coaching trait that I had, and it tested under extreme pressure in some regards because I was thrown in the deep end. But at the same time, it also showed me that my approach and my way of dealing with those challenges was actually really successful, to take a deep breath, step back, think of a plan and then present the plan to the players, or present the plan to myself in terms of the area I was heading into.
And that journey took you to Ireland, Scotland, England, and of course back to Wellington. And you come back to Wellington and you're an assistant coach. And what I find really interesting is that you step up from that assistant coach into the head coach role. For a lot of people, that transition of having peers and then leading them is difficult. I'm just really curious, Glenn, how did you manage that transition?
Yeah, I was very fortunate that it was a gradual process. I was involved as an assistant coach for 7 years, but fortunate in the regards throughout that time. Firstly, when Jamie Siddons was a coach, he had 3 young kids, so he had time away with, as we all do when we've got young kids, from time to time, missed the odd training here, missed the odd game here and there. So I was lucky in those early days. I got opportunities without leading the team for weeks on end or matches on end. I got small little snippets of how I wanted to go about it. And, you know, I couldn't really change anything. Not that I would change anything. I had to kind of keep the ship rolling how Jamie had it rolling, which was fine. And then latterly, Bruce Edgar came on as head coach, and similar with him, had the odd training, odd match here and there. And in Bruce's last season, I got to lead a campaign, which was, I guess, the last step in that transition, going from assistant coach to a head coach. And that certainly helped a lot. The key challenge I felt along that whole journey was maintaining the relationships that I've built up over a long period of time with all the players. So my main key focus was just to be myself and just to continue being myself. I didn't want to change my philosophy, change my coaching style, change my character traits. I was still the same person. I just had a different role title, and with that different role title came different responsibilities. So, yeah, fortunate I did get that opportunity through those other two coaches to transition very gradually through that. Otherwise, I don't know how it would have gone, just because it can go the other way with a lot of coaches. I've seen it a few times before where all of a sudden they're thrusted into a head coach role and they completely change the way they are and the way they go about things, and it's not necessarily who they are. So that authenticity as a coach and a person is very important in a player's eyes.
Glenn, I've got this great quote from you, and I'd like to read it before I ask the next question. You say, every team probably sits down and talks about some key words like commitment, excellence, determination, whatever it may be, coming up with these words that they want to live by. But the hard thing is actually living them. So we try to live them through sharing experiences. I was really intrigued by this idea of sharing experiences. Could you tell us how that works?
Yeah, sure. The first part of it was sharing them through players demonstrating those values. So what I mean by that is we're going through a game of cricket. Traditionally, you might focus on things like batting, bowling, fielding, dot balls, boundaries, saving runs, bowling maidens, all those things that are always going to be visible for anybody to see around the world. So instead of focusing on that, we focused on our values of things like commitment and passion and excellence. And sometimes it was other words that we felt were really important to the team. And we made them a real focus for the training and for the game. So, for instance, let's say it was commitment. In terms of our game review, everything revolved around that word commitment. So it wasn't necessarily me talking about commitment. It was me saying to the group, who saw commitment today? What did you see? How did they show it? How did it contribute to the team? And that's where the shared experiences comes back. It's all built around the game of cricket, but players talking about other players, about how they showed commitment, really brought those values to life and showed that they were not just words on paper and they're things that we were trying to live, which was a great part and certainly helped our success. We also started to get past players in to talk about their experiences as players, and I prompted them quite often to give them some suggestions around how we're trying to, I guess, move towards as a team in terms of the values. And they talked about their experiences, you know, in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and how they show those values as a team, or how certain players show those values to the team. And that did three things, really. It brought values to life, but also connected the past with the present and made those values so much more powerful, because there was something tangible that the current players could hold on to from what the past player had said. So it's a real challenge, because quite often you do a value session and it kind of gets put to the bottom of the drawer for the rest of the season, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of care and attention to continue it.
I think connecting the past with the present has also been a theme you've explored by looking at the history of the ground and the team and the stadium, if my research is correct.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Basin Reserve, it's one of the most historic grounds in New Zealand. It used to be a swamp back, 120, 130 years ago. So absolutely, we tried to touch on that as to what the ground has been through cricket-wise. They played football there. They played AFL there. It's been a swamp. It's been a tip. It's been numerous things. So the early settlers were in there. I think it was a wharf at some stage. So we share stories around that. And a lot of the stories I can't share because I wasn't around in the 1800s and not many people were in this day and age. So we try and get people in that are really knowledgeable on those certain subjects, and they talk about it and like the values. And then when you're out there representing your province, hopefully these things start to flood back into the players' minds when it's a pressure situation or the game's on the line, or where they're questioning whether they die for that ball or not. It's trying to bring the representation or what they're representing to a bigger purpose than just themselves and just the team. It's a whole lot more than that.
Glenn, New Zealand cricket has a well-being policy that allows players and coaches to take time off and refresh. But the flip side is it also gives other people a chance. Tell us what happened to you.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. And I still, every time I say it, I do get goosebumps. And even when you just ask the question there, I just get a bit of a tingle down my spine, because it was a fantastic experience and something I'll remember for the rest of my life. But I was working down at the Sky Stadium with my good mate Doug Watson, doing some coaching, and I had a couple of missed calls from New Zealand Cricket. And at the time, you kind of think, oh, what a New Zealand Cricket wanting to get hold of me. It's the middle of winter, and we're in lockdown. We've just come out of lockdowns and things like the rest of the world. So I rung back Brian Stronach from New Zealand Cricket later that afternoon, and he jumped straight in and said, oh, we want you to be the Black Caps coach for the Bangladesh and Pakistan tours. And I was speechless. I had no idea what to say. Well, I said yes, obviously, but that was just the natural reaction was yes. And then I took 3 or 4 hours before I actually told anybody, because I needed it to really sink in. And I got home and sat down with my partner and told her, and she her reaction, because I wasn't quite sure how it was going to go, given we've got young kids and, we're in a pandemic at the moment, and I was going to be kind of ditching them for that. But her reaction was one of pure excitement, which made me even more excited. So yeah, a very surreal moment, but a very special moment that I'll look back on years to come with a huge amount of pride in.
I don't think you're finished with the Black Caps coaching just yet, but we can potentially get to that a little bit later on. Glenn, language isn't very important to you, and I've read where you try not to use the word development. Can you tell us about your approach to communication?
Yeah, I've done a huge amount of study on language and words, and done a huge amount of reading on it. And it's confused me, but it's also clarified my thinking. I think naturally when you get more knowledge and do more research, it can challenge your philosophies and your way of thinking. But certainly, in the long run, I saw the benefits of language because I experimented and tried a lot of these philosophies out with players and teams. And I think the words that you use have a huge impact on how players either interpret you or misinterpret you. So what you say is very important. And the end goal for me is trying to get the player to understand you, but you're wanting them to understand you so they do improve. Ultimately, that's what the end goal is. We want players to improve so they're better. And yes, use that example about development. And what I try and do, I've done it probably for the last 4 years now, is I go into every training session and I give myself mini goals. So for instance, I had a phase where I didn't want to use the word why. So I took that completely out of my vocabulary when I was talking to players. And the reason I wanted to do that was because the word why can be a little bit imposing. It could be seen that you're questioning a person's motive for doing something. And it can be a player can put a wall up. And then if they put the wall up or if they feel that defensive nature, you're not going to get much out of them. They're certainly not going to learn from what you're trying to help them with. So that did a couple of things. It certainly challenged my coaching because I had to ask questions in a different way, using the words, what made you make that decision? How did you come to that decision? Could you have made a different decision? Did you have another option? So instead of just saying, why did you do that? I had 4, 5, 6 different options to not just ask one question, but ask more questions to dig a little bit deeper into the player's mindset, to bring more to the surface, which is hopefully going to get a better outcome for both the player and me, because we're going to understand each other a lot better. So, look, I found it, and I still find it very, very challenging, because ultimately you want to get 100% learning capacity off a player every time you talk to them or every time you coach them. And maybe that's not achievable, but that's something that I'm certainly striving for as a coach, because with that you're going to have players that are going to improve quicker, and if they improve quicker, they're going to become better quicker, and the outcomes are going to be better, which ultimately is a goal that every coach wants their players to achieve.
Is there an example of another experiment you've run with language that you could share with us?
Yeah, I've used a lot of words. Like I've used the word try not to use the word how. Why is definitely the one I've focused on, because that's the one during my research has said that that's the one that we've got to try and stop using. Not so much other words, but I've tried to give no feedback. So I might just ask questions and give no feedback. And again, the reason for this is to remove any judgment, because quite often we'll ask a question, somebody will answer it, and then we'll jump in and we'll give our point of view, which in some instances, that's fine. But I felt at a time with some players that it was better for me just to listen and observe and give them the opportunity. So I just listened. And again, that's a challenge, because as a coach, you have to say something. You're the leader. You know, it's your role to help them. And in some instances, yes, that is the case. So I felt, yeah, I want to try and remove any judgment of players and just listen. And I thought I found that so rewarding, because with the particular players I've tried it with, you just see their confidence rise, because they're basically being given a voice. And they're being allowed to share their own opinion without somebody giving them another option or telling them to try something else or going in another direction.
Glenn, I've also heard you talk about the importance of mind management. That's the phrase that you use. And you talk about it in the context of controlling the mind under pressure. Now, if someone wanted to get better at helping their teams achieve this, where would you tell them to start?
The simple answer is training more under pressure. And pressure comes in different forms. In cricket, pressure comes with scoreboard, with runs and wickets and wins and losses and a fast bowler, slow bowler, skill levels. So it's really trying to test a lot of that under pressure. But also thinking a little bit outside the box, which is where I try and be quite innovative with trying to do those things, but do them in a slightly different way. So I did one a couple of weeks ago where I was throwing balls to a player and I switched the pitch around so it was diagonal facing. And this is in an indoor centre where players are just not used to that. They're used to everything being straight lines. There's a background where they can see the ball, and you become quite robotic in that motion, similar to a cricket pitch. So I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go diagonal and just see how it goes. Different background, slightly different surface. And it was great. I debriefed the players afterwards and I said, how did you find that? And they said it was really challenging because we've never have to face that way. We've always faced this way. And how did it affect your mind? Well, started to think about the surface and about why has he changed the parameters here with our training and what's going on in his mind. So all the things that would happen in a game but slightly different. So we discussed, okay, if that happens in a game, what do you need to think about? And then that gets them back to your original question around the mind management. You know, do you want to be thinking those thoughts, or is there another thing you want to be thinking about? So for me, it's just trying to be, just trying to create pressure or anxiety. And then the key part of all of that is talking about it at the end and then having a strategy for when you do it next. And we're in Wellington and probably most parts of New Zealand, we're indoors for 5-6 months of the year. So we do a lot of training and it's easy just to hit balls and not train the mind. That's not really going to be any benefit whatsoever. So trying to do examples like that and get deep into the mind and get them uncomfortable and then come again the next day and try it again and incorporate some of those strategies really helps players prepare for what they may face in a game in a slightly different context.
Glenn, I know that data is very important to you as a coach. You use it a lot. You talk about how you use it, but I'm wondering if you could share an example of a time you looked beyond the data to improve performance.
Yeah, this is a good question too, because you're right. It's I do use data because it's so valuable and it's so readily available with cricket. The game is so outcome-based. But it does only tell a part of the story. But I've got a really good example with this where we had a player who was our fastest in our group with all the running tests. And then in the match, he looked really slow and labored. And, we labeled him from what we saw in a match as being lazy because we had the data and then we saw what we saw with our eyes and we thought, okay, he's being lazy, which is a pretty unfair perception from us. And the way we kind of look through the data is we really tried to study this player and in a match situation, find out what was going on. And we figured out he was slow off the mark, more in the outfield, slow off the mark and not getting there quick. So we thought, no, it's not laziness because he is going. And what we did is we found out it was just an awareness issue. So I think if we just stuck to the data, we would have thought this guy needs to be the fastest because he is the fastest in our tests. However, we did look a little bit further than that and think, well, he is fast at the test, but that's running in straight lines, whereas when he's out in the outfield, he's got to anticipate whether he's going to go to left, right, backwards, forwards, or does he stay still because the ball's hit over his head. All of those things happen quickly, and then you've got to make a decision. So it was a really good example, even though it's not necessarily batting and bowling relating, it was a really good example to take the data with a little bit of the grain of salt and then almost form your own opinions from what you see. And from that example, we tried to help him with a lot of not running drills because we knew he could run really fast. We used a lot of drills around hand awareness and anticipation and speed off the mark, which was brilliant. And then the end result was he started to get a little bit faster in the cricket context.
I was also fascinated to hear how you used an optometrist within the team, which I thought was brilliant. Could you tell us a little bit about the exercise and the benefit the team got from it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that player that just talked about, he was one of the players that benefited from that because like a simple drill that the lady we had was involved with netball. And she reached out to us because she wanted to tap into the cricket market, given the speed of how things happen and the role of the eyes. But so for that particular player that I just talked about, is she set up a whole lot of lights on the ground, red lights, green lights, yellow lights, orange lights, and they all went off at different times, and this player had to go and tap the colour that went off. So a real unique way of speeding up his speed to the mark without using a cricket ball and without using a batsman. But like the main area I found it really useful is in terms of the eyes, is more the peripheral vision. Eyesight was so important, not just cricket. It's very important in all sports. We're good at looking straight, and we need to look straight, but there's so much going on the outer edges of our eyes. You take fielding for an example. There's two guys running for the ball. There's a ball in the air. There's runners between the wicket. There's a crowd. There's a boundary rope. And you need to have an awareness of where all that stuff is. You can't look at all that because you're looking at the ball, hopefully. But your peripheral vision needs to be aware of all those surroundings. So she did heaps of exercises around that, like exercises. And the thing that I really liked what she tried, and some players gravitated and some didn't, but she really advocated that we played 5 minutes of video games before batsmen went out to bat. And the reasoning behind it was, it was basically just speeding up the hand-eye coordination and the reflexes. So when you go out to bat, you don't take two or three balls to get used to that fast-paced nature of the game, which was fascinating. It's quite visionary, and as I said, a few players really picked up on it and quite liked it, and other players, it wasn't for them. So I thought a really unique way to help a player prepare, especially in the modern 2020 format. That's, you know, not just sitting in a chair watching the game and then going out cold.
Glenn, batsmen spend a lot of time alone out in the middle. Yes, they got a person, you know, 20 feet away from them, but for the most part of it, they're alone. How do you help them deal with negative self-talk that could potentially bubble up while they're waiting for the next delivery?
No, it's one of the biggest challenges for batsmen. I don't think you're ever going to alleviate it. I think there's always going to be moments where that little birdie pops into your head of doubt or whatever it may be. But I guess two ways I go about it. Firstly, from a training perspective, it's really ensuring that the players have got a clear process in terms of how they're going to score runs. So what is your plan? And really concentrating on that plan and thinking about that plan. There's a lot of other techniques around visualization and breathing, and those things are good too because they give you something else to focus on. But I think the process of having a plan, it's positive reinforcement about what you're trying to do as opposed to what you're not trying to do. And the second part of that is around, you know, the match day type confidence or the match day anxiety where those fears could come into your mind. So for that, it's really trying to instill those positive messages with the players. And I use imagery a lot with my communications with players. So that might be sending a player a video of them performing really well the year before against the same team that we're coming up against, or at a ground we're going to, or against the bowlers we're going to be coming up against. And I either send them that the night before a match or the morning of the match. So the night before the match, so hopefully they watch it before they go to bed and they're having the best dreams ever about them going out and getting 100. Or conversely, first thing in the morning, they're opening it up, they're looking at it, and again, they're thinking positively about how they can perform that day. None of that guarantees that little birdie is not going to pop in their head, but you know, I think they're things that I've really gravitated towards through my experience as a coach, and I believe more often than not they do help alleviate some of those thoughts that can pop into the batsmen's minds.
What gives you confidence as a coach, Glenn?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great question. No one's ever asked me that. And I definitely get confidence from preparation, just being prepared. And I've had to be really prepared early on in my career, given I'd never played to a high level. I became a bit of a compulsive planner, and just being very detailed in what I needed to do and how I wanted to run a training session. I've definitely learned to be a lot more flexible as time's gone on. That's just due to experience, but I definitely get confidence just from being well prepared for a coaching session, for a game. And the second part of confidence is I think it's hard not to get confidence from having success, whether that's team success or player success. But I think I probably take more confidence from seeing players perform individually, because team-wise, there's a lot of different moving parts that contribute to that. And essentially, when they go over the white line, the captain's the one who's pulling all the strings, so he holds a huge amount of the responsibility, and also a lot of the kudos needs to go to that person in that situation. But seeing players perform individually take a lot of confidence, because you have a huge amount of time with players individually, and I feel you have a lot more control of them putting their best foot forward in terms of performance.
Glenn, just perhaps one last question before we finish, and it's again, I'd like to read a quote to you before I ask the question. You say, "I fell in love with coaching because it was pretty cool seeing other people do well and other people live out some of their dreams and some of their hopes that they wanted to achieve, and seeing people smile and things like that. It gave me a different buzz." So I'd like to just close by asking, in the distant, distant future, when you do retire and hang up that whistle, pack away the clipboard, what's the legacy with these people you've helped smile that you would like to have achieved?
Yeah, it's one of the questions you kind of constantly ask on coaching courses and forums around philosophies and legacies. And look, it really evolves for me. But I think the main thing for me is that they've enjoyed the experiences that they've been a part of. And an experience for me is, it's a match, yes, it's a training. It might be a meal out. It might be time in the changing room. It might just be a one-on-one interaction. So if they can go away and I can go away and we've enjoyed those experiences, then for me that'll be a massive result. And the other part for me is really, of late anyway, is my philosophy's been a lot more about the individual, and it does get a little bit against some coaches' philosophies, where it's a little bit more around the team and team first. But I find it really important that in the environments I'm in, I need to work and adapt around the individual players' needs and what suits them, as opposed to the other way, where they have to conform or they have to buy in, to use a better word, of how we do things. And I feel that's the way the modern game has gone now. We have to adapt to individuals and not give them leniency, but understand their needs and understand their challenges, because if we do, we're going to get the best out of that player, and if we get the best out of the player, the natural result is they're going to be a great team player and they're going to be a team first player. So as I said, it's certainly, my philosophy's changed, and it's a lot more around the player as opposed to the team, and working with all those players on an individual level to get the best out of them.
Oh, Glenn, it's been great meeting you today and spending a little bit of time listening to your story. I'm sure you're going to be back coaching the Black Caps one day, and I wish you all the best with that, unless you're playing Australia.
Thanks for that, Paul.
Hi, everyone. You have been listening to the great coach, Glenn Pocknell. I hope you got a lot out of Glenn's reflective and deep style and found a few ideas that you can bring to your own dinner table, locker room, or boardroom table for discussion. Glenn was a great guest, very honest and forthright, and some of the key highlights for me when I listened back were the way he prioritises asking questions when working with athletes so that he can maximise the learning capacity of every interaction he has with them. How he moved beyond talking about team values to creating moments when they could experience these values together. And how, when he was promoted from within the team into the head coach role, He stayed focused on being authentic and trying not to change his style in the way that he had seen other first-time head coaches do. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And just before we go, if you have any feedback, then please let us know. The interaction with the people around the world who listen gives us great energy and keeps us going. All the details on how to connect with us are in the show notes or on our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com.